Seattle, Washington, April 23rd, 1980. This is side one, the first part of two tapes, an interview between Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, Labor Research Specialist, University of Minnesota Labor Education Service, and myself concerning the Minneapolis General Driver Strikes of 1934.
Good morning, Mr. Malone.
Oh, fine. You?
I'm very well.
Nice day here.
You are having good weather out there.
Yeah.
Well, you're lucky you haven't been here a lot today. It's been blistering.
It's been a heat wave, I heard.
Yeah, 90s. Good for a change, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy, that's too dramatic.
Yeah? How are you feeling?
Oh, fair.
Good. Are you over your cold?
Well, I don't know if I'm over it. It seems like it haunts me. I have every once in a while, an irritation in the throat that makes you want to cough now and then, that's all.
How about your arm?
Oh, that's still the same way. I'm not using it much, so it doesn't bother, but if I activate it, it starts to let me know that it's something wrong.
Are you going to have that operation?
I want to have it done, but I want to calculate everything so that there's a projection that there's a 6 to 8 week period in a airplane sling, you know, your arm is extended.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I'm dreading that, and I want to make sure that I've got everything in order that I can devote 2 full months to that if I need to. And I don't see that in the immediate future, so I just got to tolerate the arm and not try to do anything and get frisky with it.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense. Boy, it wouldn't be very pleasant to spend the hottest months of the cast, would it?
Oh, you're right there.
Will it be in a cast?
What?
Will it be in a cast?
Well, they call it an airplane cast. They don't put it really in a cast, an airplane sling.
I see.
And they project the arm in such a manner that it doesn't move, you know. I'm kind of bohemian in my lifestyle, but I don't think I could endure 2 months of that without some kind of care, you know, so I have to make all kind of arrangements.
Yeah.
It's not a pleasant thing, but I'll have to find out.
Yeah, it doesn't sound too good. Well, I feel as though I should report to you, Mr. Maloney, on how things are progressing in terms of the reunion that we have planned for July 20th. We have met with the Minnesota Humanities Commission about they're giving us some funds to hold a panel discussion which would include individuals who participate. The panelists would include individuals who participated in the strike along with a humanities scholar, which the Humanities Commission requires to be a part of programs that they fund.
Yeah.
And we may try to include someone from the Citizens Alliance or someone from that perspective.
Well, you'd have to have, wouldn't you?
Well, I think so. We have to see what kind of...
I think they want it. They want a well-rounded thing. They just don't want what they call propaganda.
Right. And the panel has to be engaged in direct exchange with a public audience, so that's what we're trying to figure out right now. I've been meeting with some Teamster retirees on a very regular basis, and I'll be meeting with the executive board to secure more definitely plans for the panel and for the rest of the reunion and establishing volunteer committees and so forth. But what I'd like to get from you is I would like to know if you would be willing to serve as one of the panelists on the panel for which we hope to receive funds from the Minnesota Humanities Commission.
Well, I would serve on the panel. And how long a period of time does that take?
Well, we're not sure if it is something that we will make as a very informal type of panel discussion and hold it at the picnic, or if we will hold it after or before the picnic. But the point of this is that if you will serve as a panelist, the Humanities Commission will pay for your transportation here and back, and will also pay for lodging expenses and so forth. And this is something that I would include your name as one of the panelists we want on the panel.
Very well.
If we approve the grant, then we could fund you. You would be funded to come out here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also trying to locate other funds so that in the event that our proposal is not accepted by the Humanities Commission.
Yeah, you have an alternate source.
There will be another way of assuring that you are here to celebrate with us on July 20th.
Now, if I understand you, this panel is, what is that, a one-shot deal, or is it a continued thing?
No, it would be a
one-shot. I have no objection it being continued. I was just curious as to the time span.
Well, what we figured is, we haven't nailed down, we just talked with the director of the Humanities Commission on Tuesday, and
mm-hmm.
he, of course, has changed the focus of what we wanted to do somewhat. He cannot fund the reunion in any way, except if we do a panel, and then he can only fund the costs of doing a panel discussion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand that. But I mean, would the panel itself be more than a one-shot deal? Would it be a continued, like, a week or so?
Probably not. But what may happen is that, what will happen is definitely if the panel discussion takes place at the reunion, it'll be audio and videotaped.
Mm-hmm.
You may then, the day after the picnic, hold a studio discussion.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Yeah, sometimes, they want to do retakes and things like that. I have no objection. I'm just curious as to the time span.
Yeah, so what it would really allow is for you to come in and participate in the panel and the reunion. And I'm sure you could stay as long as you like. Your round-trip airfare would be paid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that you would be free if there were other events we wanted.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at. Is it fair to say it would be done in a week or 2 weeks?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, very well. I just kind of lined the thing out from, say, the 15th of July then to the 1st of August.
I think that would give plenty of time.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, what the hell? Let's put that on the big ship, a day or two one way or the other.
But as I said, I have not absolutely secured funds for you, but I am working very hard on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if all goes well, we'll get to meet face to face, and you'll get to join us in our celebration out here.
Yeah. Now, you said something about the executive board. That'd be the Teamster Joint Council.
Well, we've already met with the Teamsters Joint Council 32 Executive Board. Which unanimously approved, our plans for the picnic at the quarterly meeting in March. I'll be meeting with the Minnesota Teamsters Retirees Club Executive Board.
Oh, that's the group.
Yeah, next week.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will be the project director of this grant, but they will be the applicant group.
Mm-hmm.
And they technically, but not actually, will be the recipient of the grant.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. So I'll be meeting with them next week to secure their approval of my going ahead and making the grant application.
Mm-hmm.
And to further discuss establishing volunteer committees to do the different tasks that need to be done to prepare for the reunion.
Mm-hmm.
So, So that's where...
I would serve as a panelist, and if you want any written form, you just address it to me and I'll respond.
Okay, well, I'm glad to hear that because the Humanities Commission, the grant is due May 9th, and the director requested that we have at least tentative confirmation from our panelists.
You just send me out whatever you want, and I'll respond.
Okay, I don't know if I'll have to send you a... It might be helpful if you could just write me a note saying that you agree to serve as a panelist.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I would have it in written form.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a long letter. It could be, you know, that you agree to serve as a panelist. That would suffice.
And that'll be addressed to you.
Yeah, you can address that right
now. And what would be the title of what are you calling this project?
Let's see, that's a good question, Mr. Maloney.
I can improvise in regards to our conversation.
Yeah.
This will confirm my...
I think that would probably be okay, as long as it's clear that it's the panel discussion being held in connection with the commemoration of the...
1934 General Driver's Strike.
Right.
Very well, I can do that.
Oh, good, okay. Well, we are also interested in asking Farrell Dodds to join us at that time and possibly serve as a panelist if he can do that. Do you have any feelings about that?
Oh, I would like to see him, but I don't know about him. He's kind of, he takes a pretty firm position on being retired from organizational activity.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife, who I don't think she's up and about and everything, but I know she has a kind of a delicate diet problem, and cooking and eating has to be carefully supervised. And both Farrell and her are over 70, and I couldn't say. You'd have to talk with him directly.
Okay.
Hmm?
All right, well, that's good information to have.
But Harry DeBoer is around there.
Oh, yeah, he's going to get a very direct personal invitation. He'll get a very direct personal invitation to the reunion, and if Farrell cannot come, we can ask Harry to serve on the panel.
Mm-hmm. I would like to see Farrell because he sure puts things in perspective so quickly, you know.
Uh-huh. Oh, I feel it's almost essential that we have him out here. So if his health and disposition permits, I think that we should...
Well, I think his health is all right, but he's, he's been married to Marvel since about 25, I guess, and they're kind of inseparable and kind of, you don't often see that monogamous thing, anymore.
Well, more power to him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Should we talk more about some people here?
Well, the last thing, I don't want to prompt you, but the last thing you told me, and I had it on my note, why I went to jail, and I had it marked April 23rd. Now, if you want to get into that or people, it's up to you.
Okay, well, let's see. I'm wondering if we should continue with the people and cover the your jailing experience later.
All right, that's okay. I just want to do, I have everything. I mark things down on notes.
Yeah.
And it says, why in jail? You said you were running out of tape and you'd like to catch it when you had tape, so.
Yeah. Well, I think that if we continue in the flow of talking about people and come back to some of these...
Very well, that's okay. You make a note then.
Yeah, let's do that. And we needed to continue with the Dunn brothers.
Yeah, we temporarily had went over Ray.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know who you want to talk about next, Miles or Grant.
Well, is there a logical order in your mind?
No, it doesn't make any difference.
Okay, well, there isn't in my mind either, so...
All right, now, you understand if we talk about Miles and if we use the word Mickey...
Okay.
We're talking about the same person.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Miles Bernard Dunn, and everyone called him Mickey. Now, Mick was, I don't know where he fit in the lineup of the brothers. He was somewhere probably down the middle, I suppose. I don't know his exact age. I think he was older than Grant, but I'm not sure. Makes no never mind. Anyhow, there's only been a year or two, a couple of years maybe. Now, Mickey, as I understand, in his early youth, had the family lived in up by Little Falls, and they were close neighbors to the Lindbergh family, Charles Lindbergh the Flyer, and the old man Lindbergh. Old man Lindbergh, as you know, was a representative in the state of Minnesota. He was with some of the farm labor people. I don't know where he, I suppose he was farm labor, right? I'm not sure. But he took a stand as an isolationist, and he was ostracized for that, but somewhere along the line after America got in the war, just prior to that, why, he swallowed the anchor and he got on the bandwagon, according to my history. So they were raised up neighbors there, and the only, I'm just putting that in for a little geographical background, and perhaps that may have had some influence, but what, if I remember Mickey telling me that early in life, I think his mother, who was, as I have told you before, was a very devout Catholic person, had aspired that he go into the priesthood. Now, there is a college up north of St. Cloud. I think it's St. John's, a few miles north of St. Cloud. Now, I don't know where Mickey went there, or wherever he went. They went to some sort of a parochial school. And Mickey told me that he was learning to talk from the brothers. Now, I don't know if these were non-ordained persons or whether they were ordained priests, all of them. But they were teaching him to talk. And for the amphitheater where he learned was a corrugated metal barn, and of course the acoustics in it was awful. So in order to talk in such a terrible thing, you had to really understand how to handle your voice and inflections of speech and all of those sorts of things. And Mickey was certainly a crackerjack. I consider him one of the best orators, I mean, for talking to people. Not in the same sense of Bill Brown. I don't think Bill Brown could have been surpassed in his agitational talks. And he's close down to the people. Mickey was close to the people, but his style was a little bit more, well, his oratory was a little more polished than Brown's, but not any more effective. But he certainly was a beautiful talker. Now, Mick and Grant, I think, were in the World War I. I know Grant was, and I think Mickey was. I know George Froesig was, so they were all about the same age bracket. Mickey was a very quick, volatile guy, great sense of humor, happy-go-lucky, could be very firm, at the same time didn't get nasty or belligerent doing it. He was just very straight and set in his ways, and he was a very easy-going guy. I mean, he could fit in with anybody, and a real light-hearted, jocular fellow, but he was not a buffoon or anything. He was a serious guy, too, but I mean, he had just a warm personality. Ray was a very warm guy, but his personality, as I've told you before, was more the quiet, studious, pedantic, reserved type, where Mickey was just real outward. Ray was not an introvert, but he was not in the same sense that Mickey was, friendly guy.
Well, Mickey was very social.
Oh, yes, he was extra social. And always had a joke and was quick-witted. Now, Mickey, at one time, I don't know all of Mickey's employment record, but for a while he worked, there was a company in Minneapolis, I think the name was Baker, but they used to paint filling stations in the summer. They had a fleet of trucks, and during the summer, when it was good painting weather, I think they had a contract for some of the big, there were two or three big chains of filling stations, and there was Standard Oil, there was City Service, there was Pure Oil, and Sinclair. They were the big three or four that I recall. And this company used to, had a contract to paint their service stations in the summertime. And Mick told me that he'd worked for them sometimes, I don't know for how long, as a painter. They had a truck and they'd go out and paint the stations. I suppose they'd spend 2, 3, 4 days at a station and go on to another one. Mm-hmm. That would be in the summer months. Now in the winter months, he would haul coal. Now I don't know when Mickey started hauling coal. I remember Carl Skoglund telling me that he, Carl Skoglund is, bought a truck, I think in about 1926 or 27. I don't know if Mickey started that soon or not. But he had been working in the coal yards from the beginning of the Depression at least. And Mick was, I suppose, the first to go into the local 574. Now, I can't remember him anything. I don't put a milepost on Mickey until about until after April of 1933. And the reason I'm so emphatic about that is that Beer come back in 1933 in April. Mm-hmm. And it was sometime after that that I was in a tavern, or a saloon, as we called them back there. And Mickey was there. We'd been to a union meeting, and the union meetings weren't much in those days. And that had had to be in the spring, early summer of 1933 that I remember Mickey and Carl. Now, I'd seen Carl around earlier, but I didn't pay too much attention to Mick. They were hauling coal, and they were working out of the fuel distributor's yard. And Ray was a scale master, as we've talked about before.
Right.
Now it was Mickey and Carl who had approached George Guider, G-U-I-D-E-R. George Guider was the business agent of Local 221, at that time was called the Ice and Coal Wagon Drivers Union. And they wanted to join 221. And Guider, of course, who being the business agent, looked upon them as independent truck owners. Now, Mick did not own his own truck. I think he and Carl worked together on it. If Mickey ever owned his own truck, I didn't know about it. Carl did. Mm-hmm. Carl had a Ford and Carl had an International. So I don't know if Mickey drove one and Carl the other, or the trucks come. I know in 1934, Carl still had the International. Well, they went to Guider, according to what Mick told me, and Guider told him, this is later now, I wasn't talking to him in 1932, it was after we'd become established as a working union in Minneapolis, and I had several personal associations with Mickey that were closer than either Grant and Ray, and well, he told me that they'd approached Guider, and Guider had turned them down, and of course it was obvious the reason. At first they were a little perplexed, and then it became clear to them that Cedar Lake Ice and Coal had a contract with the union. And of course, one of the things was the patronage that went with that contract. You could say this is a union company, therefore we're entitled to union business. Now, on the other hand, if Cedar Lake Ice and Coal had to share the patronage, it would diminish potential customers, and I suppose they frowned on it, and Guider didn't want to do anything that would make Cedar Lake Ice and Coal think unkindly of him. Mm-hmm. So he turned them down. And then, of course, Mickey Dunn and Skogie then went to Bill Brown. And Bill, of course, being the guy that he was, hell yes, he says, it's an Irish fight, everybody can join. I suppose would be his answer. But this was, I can't give you the time frame on that. I remember Mickey from April, May of 1933. And briefly, now I was working for a transfer company. They were working in a coal industry. We didn't have a great degree of reason to talk, as I've told you before, the difference in the industry. But you'd see them. And I have a fair memory, and I remember things and people, and that's about all I can think of Mickey at the time. Well, obviously during the summer of 1933, Mickey and Carl, Ray, Grant, and some of the other coal haulers, C.B. Carlson, Chris Moe, I think Louis Roseland was in on that. They were talking, I suppose, what they were going to do, and of course the Depression was still grinding down, you know, it hadn't started to turn around yet. And there was talk about fellows going back to work in the fall of the year at a lesser rate of pay or price per ton. It was no wage rate, it was a commission, as I explained to you. They worked by the ton, whatever they hauled by the ton. They got paid X dollars or X cents per ton. Now, what Mickey told me was that during the summer of 1933, they had been putting things together to get a contract. Apparently, they'd been having some degree of close association with Bill Brown. Now, Bill Brown was a full-time functionary for the Teamster Joint Council. He was president of 574, but I can't remember, but he was the business agent for the Teamster Joint Council, or the business rep, or whatever they want to call him. And they had no doubt been talking with Bill quite a bit, and they had got to the point where they had a kind of a broader organizing committee. Now, in addition to just fellows that owned their own trucks, most of the fellows I spoke about before, Ray Dunn, of course, did not own a truck. Grant Dunn, Harry DeBoer, Kelly Postal, they did not own trucks. Mickey, I don't think, did. But Carl did, Chris Moe did, C.B. Carlson, and there were some others. Now then, there was a group of drivers that drove company trucks. And among them was Clarence Hamill, Vic Stament, Don Tutty. They were working for the bigger coal yards that had their own fleets. And of course, it was seasonal employment, except for a few men hauling steam coal. And during the summer, the domestic coal, because there's no need for it, there was none. All these domestic coal haulers were laid off in the summer. And the ones that they kept were generally guys that drove the steam coal trucks, the big ones, and if they had to have a domestic order delivered, one of them guys would grab a small truck and yard it out. They were working, according to Mickey, that summer, drawing up a set of demands to be presented to the coal operators and polishing them up according to the rules of the Teamsters Union and have them approved by the general president and all that monkey business. And I remember Mickey then being active. I'd go up to the hall every once in a while, and quite frequently Mickey and Carl, some other guys whose names now slip my mind, would be around. Well, the hall that time, the union offices were at 614 First Avenue North, up on the second floor. And Cliff Hall was the business agent. And having a session with Cliff Hall was like having a session with a skunk. You didn't like it while you were there, and it stayed with you a long time after it left. And so no one was too anxious to talk to the little guy. Mm-hmm. But Mick, as I knew him, was pretty sharp and persevering and plugging along. And it was he and Carl Skoglund who were in the union meetings. We used to meet every other Monday night, as I remember. And I didn't make every meeting. A lot of nights you worked, other nights you didn't go. There wasn't a hell of a lot of interest. And so they were carrying on this argument in the fall, in the spring, in the summer, and early fall of 1933. As I said, Mick was a beautiful talker, but I don't recall seeing Mickey on the floor of the union meetings.
So you got the sense that something was brewing more from Mickey than you did from attending the union meetings?
Well, really not at that time. Something was brewing. I knew they were around. And there was some talk. But you see, the industry was pretty diversified. And the problem of a coal hauler and a transfer driver didn't have a great deal of, there wasn't a great deal of communication between the two groups. Mm-hmm. As I explained to you earlier, my experience in the coal yards had been mostly when the big transfer companies or trucking companies had trucks to haul coal, dump trucks and the like of that, they'd call you in an emergency to work. So I didn't have a close working relationship with the coal industry. And I want to tell you that in the summer of 1933, thinking that within a few months there'd be such a dramatic change in the Minneapolis driving industry, I don't think I would have believed it, and I didn't associate it at the time that all these great developments were going to come to pass. Later on, I had a couple of occasions to sit down and talk with Carl, and Carl was more, well, Mickey was a friendly guy, as you say, social. But Carl talked to me a couple of different times.
Mr. Maloney, I'm sorry. Yeah. My connection with the tape recorder just fell off the telephone this morning.
All right.
Okay, I have it resecured. Okay, go ahead.
Now then, I had a couple of conversations with Carl. And it centered around what was ahead for the drivers and what could be done. Well, now, as I told you earlier, it was Carl Skoglund who convinced me that there was a possibility that the driving industry in Minneapolis could be established into where it wouldn't be such a terrible, awful place to work and to live as it was. So he had a couple of discussions with me, and he was concerned about what happened out on the road, what kind of conditions did we work under. And I suppose what Carl was doing was picking the minds of everybody he could meet that would give him an insight into a section of the industry that he wasn't totally familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a stupendous man, you know, and it didn't take a hell of a lot for Carl to envision what was going on. But I didn't have any such conversations with Mickey. There was a beer joint across the street, and I had a couple of rap sessions with Mick there, but I had a couple there sitting in a booth. And then one night, Bob Fleming from Local 120 was in Minneapolis, and he was having trouble with, well, there were a couple of big department stores, I don't suppose they're there now. One was the Golden Rule. And then there was a big grocery store there, chain, named a big downtown central department that had a fleet of trucks delivering groceries, called Shucks, I believe their name was. Well, he was having some problems over there, and Bob Fleming was just recently installed as the business agent of 120. And I don't know if he was over with John Gary, who was the international vice president from St. Paul, or if he's there on his own. That part phases me. But all during the time that this was going on in the summer, it's obvious that Mickey and Carl, or no doubt about it, Ray and Grant and a couple of the others were talking about what was going on and trying to do something about it. Now, in the fall of 1933, when things started to heat up, and by this time, Farrell Dobbs was starting to come around. I mean, not starting to come around, but he was becoming involved in the discussions too. And the coal yards were starting to hire people. Not hire, but I mean to employ them. For the most part, Chris, these coal yards had more or less the same string of drivers. And if you had there and you worked 1 year and nothing happened and you were still satisfactory to them at the fall of the year, you had a good chance of getting reemployed. Mm-hmm. Now, there's also the fact that employment was not on the upswing, you know. The reverse was true. It was down. So I suppose the chances of getting work depended on the volume of work there was in each yard. But they started to call back these guys. Clarence Hamill, he worked summer times for C.J. Hoygaard. That was a tent and awning company. Mm-hmm. And Vic Stament, he was a musician, too. He had a kind of a little bootleg band that he was running around working with. He was a musician. And he worked for Hudson Manufacturing. They were made tin stuff. He drove for them part-time when they had work in the summer. And they were being employed, and that's when Farrell started to work at Pittsburgh Fuel. Now, he might have worked there earlier, but my recollection is he started there in the late summer, early fall of 1933 at Pittsburgh Coal. Now, his father was a master mechanic there, and that's probably one of the reasons why Farrell got hired in there. And Farrell had a weekly job. He was getting paid by the week in the steam house, where most of the other fellows were working by the ton or by the hour.
So that's an advantage.
Well, it was an advantage, or it was not an advantage. When you worked by the week, you know, Chris, those days, you didn't go home at 5 o'clock at night. You worked till the job was done. Mm-hmm. Now, it was a real cold, nasty day where the steam plant would be running long, and your day's pay was a day. It didn't say go home at 5. They were working that yard till 7, 8 o'clock at night. You worked.
But didn't it, in a way, provide a little bit more job security?
Well, it did that.
Yeah,
what it done, I don't know if it provided any more job security, but it did provide that you knew that every week you would be getting $12 or $15 regularly.
Yeah, I think that's the advantage.
Yeah, because the whole thing depended upon if there was coal to haul, everybody worked. And if there was no call to haul, everybody sit. Well, in this instance, Farrell would get paid for sitting, but then when there was a lot of work and they made several hauls during the day, they had a little bit more money at the end of the day than he would.
Yeah, he'd make up for any sitting
yeah.
if he had done it any
mm-hmm.
Let me flip the tape.
All here. Right, let me get some water
All
then.
Right.
Seattle, Washington, April 23rd, 1980. This is side two, the second part of two tapes, an interview between Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, labor research specialist, University of Minnesota, Labor Education Service, and myself concerning the Minneapolis General Driver Strikes of 1934.
Let me
yep.
get this straightened out here.
All right.
Okay.
Now, If memory serves me right, Mickey started being quite vocal at the meetings in the fall of the year. And that coincided with the fact that they had something now to talk about. And I remember he and Carl and Ray, Ray would come to the meetings too, and Grant, they were there. But Mickey and Carl, mostly Mickey, and you couldn't, if you was at a meeting and Mickey talked, you'd remember it because, you know, it was like not going to a show or anything, but he was just such a good talker and compared to a bunch of kind of coarse, more vulgar, not so well-educated people, you know, it was quite a change to hear a guy like Mickey talking. So they were active in that period of time, and I remember mostly Mickey talking. The meetings that I went to, there were probably four, five, six meetings in that period of time that I attended, and they were talking about the coal industry, about the coal haulers. Well, I was a little, I think, probably more broad-minded than some of the other guys. Some of the guys say, what the hell do we care about them coal haulers? You know, and on top of it, most of the fellas realized they didn't identify the coal haulers as workers. They identified them as independent owners. Because most of them owned their own trucks. And they didn't identify with the yard men, and they didn't identify with the salaried people like Dobbs and a few more. But most of them were independent owners. And for some reason or other, and it's a healthy feeling, most guys look at a guy that's an owner as some sort of a guy who aspires to be a businessman and a plain downright working stiff. He says, what the hell, that guy got a different slant on life than I got. But it wasn't that outspoken, but I think there was that kind of a feeling there too. There hadn't been the experiences of listening to Ray and Carl and later Farrell explain the reason why, and the thing developed, and once it was explained, it caught on pretty well, quick.
So it sounds as though you do not agree that there was any that those individuals who owned their own trucks were more akin to businessmen than they were to workers.
Well, I considered because my dad owned his own trucks, and he was forced into that. My stepfather, as a result of the 1917 strike. And I understood pretty well that this myth that if you own a truck, tomorrow you're going to be a fleet owner was just a myth. So I think I was a little bit more understanding than some of the others. But it wasn't all that hostility. It was just the fact that they were coal haulers and hell, they had a different thing to worry about. But they were talking it up at the meetings, and I can remember they sent in, they'd been trying to negotiate with the coal operators, and the coal operators wouldn't meet them, and Mickey was reported this a couple of times at the meeting, and he wouldn't, meetings weren't big, long, deep, seated things, you know, they were kind of read the minutes, and Bill Brown would maintain a law and order there and keep the thing going, and the meetings were interesting, but they were short. And but I do remember Mickey, and I remember Carl especially. And then of course when the things heatened up, they become more and more. Every time he'd go up to the meeting, you were hearing about it. And I think a couple of times they put out handbills, if I remember, leaflets. But there was now beginning to come a little more interest in things in the Union. I could sense that, too. But what turned the tide, what changed things so dramatically in that Union, I'm a little out of step on it, was when the coal strike was won in 1934, if there was any resentment in the hearts of the guys that understood what it was all about, which was a great share of them, that these guys owned their own trucks, they had established a new status because they took the boss on and they beat him, and that had never been done in the history of most of the guys that was around there. You know, 17 years is a long period of time for people to be in a particular industry. So those that were there in 1917 and got dumped in that broken strike, it was a new crop of people around mostly. There weren't too many of the older guys around that were still stayed there from 1917. So the idea that here come a group of guys, went on strike, and won decisively. That established a new degree of respect and the old idea of anybody thinking that you owned your own truck, you're a different kind of a guy. There never was no more thoughts like that around at all. The guys had a kind of a semi-hero status, you know. They'd went out, beat the boss down, and won.
They'd prove which side they were on.
Yeah, they were. That's right. And the guys understood it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, from 1934, after the coal strike, by going to the Union Hall and not and see Mickey Dunn and Ray and Carl and Farrell around was just like not seeing anybody because they were there all the time. You know, they were going night and day, and like I told you earlier, I don't know how they done it. But they were still trying to hold down a job and trying to work, and it seemed like every time I went to the Union Hall, they were there. And now there was a little bit more interest to go in the hall because you just didn't have to put up with that stinker hall all the time. And there was a lot of things going on. So Mickey played... He played a role I don't think that too many people have recognized or gave him credit for in the fact that he helped. And those were tough days, you know. That's pretty discouraging. Every time you turn around, you got no backing. It takes a lot of perseverance and foresight to keep your eye on the ball, you know. And Mickey, he was able to do that. And, of course, Mickey was a convivial fellow, and as you say, and I say again, he was a social guy. And he made friends very easy. And he was just an asset for the Union. Well, of course, after the 34 strike, Mickey played a role in the committee of the negotiating committee. I wasn't on hand at the time. I was on a road trip and come into Minneapolis the night the coal strike was settled. I wasn't on hand for the coal strike in 34. And then all during the next period between the coal strike and May, Mickey was one of the main plugs. I think Mick was in charge of the organizing committee, if I recall correctly. He was kind of the chairman.
Well, reports that I've read about the coal strike indicate that it was a very well-planned event.
Yeah, they had it all doped out, and they knew what they had to do. And, of course, you see, here again comes the fact that this close group of people, the three Dunn brothers, Skogie and Farrell, for the most part, that were in that union, and they had a couple of other fellows that were close friends of theirs. There was an engineer, I think I've mentioned him before, C.R. Headland. And there were, well, Louis Roseland was in that coal working group too. And then there was a couple of, oh, there was Oscar Coover, the electrician. They were a close-knit group of people who were old-time socialists and who had been or were at one time members of the Communist Party, but they had a close, very close understanding and relationship in regards to how to go about things. And it was damn valuable to the drivers of Minneapolis that those guys was on deck. So they had this thing figured out pretty goddamn well. Now, in addition to the just that little group there, that nucleus, they had the broader group around. Harry DeBoer, Tut Sprink, George Dreon. Oh, I could go on and on with those guys. And Sherm Oaks. Oh, so many guys that were all involved. And unless you've been through that type of an association, it's pretty hard for me to describe it. But anyone that's had a close working relationship with a group of people where you're kind of intertwined, they have a grab on it. But by God, the way that they had a way of imparting their knowledge, and everyone felt more or less that he was part of something. It wasn't the star system where there's one star on the team and everybody else was the backup. It wasn't that way, and I think that was the success of that whole venture in Minneapolis. And all during the time that I was associated there, and up until I left in 1940, that was the concept on which, of course, they were still going after I left. But when I was jailed, rather, that's why I left. But I mean, that was the relationship that went on. And you could have bitter arguments with one another, but they were hammered out, and a program was developed, and that's the way that the thing progressed. Now, as I said, I wasn't on hand for that, but I do know that they had things pretty damn well planned out, and they figured out, and they knew where the men were, the union men. And as I say again, and I'm going to have to, if I didn't, make it clear, I've talked with Mickey. I had a lot of good associations with Mickey, and he told me, Farrell's told me, Harry DeBoer's told me, they figured out, well, we got a good yard out there where there's 20 guys in it, and they're all in the union, they're solid. Well, why should we have a man out there with a sign saying on strike? There was other yards where we weren't quite so solid. That's the places we'd concentrate. And then, of course, they felt that they'd have to shut down Cedar Lake, and they'd have to shut down Hygienic Artificial Ice. No, that wasn't it. Hawthorne Fuel, they had some sort of a working relationship with the union, and with 221. And they felt that if they didn't, that would tend to, well, people could get coal there, and that wouldn't bring any, the employers could work through. It wasn't that they were against people getting coal, they were against the employers using it as a means to break the strike. And I guess they had it figured out that Cedar Lake would have to shut down. And what Cedar Lake should have done, what George Guider should have done, they should have went out in accord with him, but they didn't, as I remember. And they had to go there and just convince the men that the thing to do was not to work. Now, Harry DeBoer developed this, what later became the Roving Picket Squad, where they claimed that was Harry's idea. And Harry's a very practical guy. And with this close relationship, it was well planned, and there's no question that Mickey had a big hand in helping work it out. And after the coal strike was over, then Mickey was, I'm sure he was the guy that was coordinating the organizing. I won't say organizing chairman, but he coordinated all the fellows to help organize the city. Now, that didn't mean that Ray and Farrell and Carl and Bill Brown weren't involved. But after all, you have to delegate authority. And Mickey was the guy that I recall, at least, that was kind of coordinating the activity and who should go here and how there. And because I know we used to meet with him night after night. And Farrell and Ray, they were busy with other matters, and Carl, and but Mick played a very key role in that whole thing, you know. He was a very articulate spokesman, grab a situation right now, and is able to step in and take over if need be. He didn't have to be, get the script and go over the lines. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in the negotiating committee, and he was on the committee during the strike of the negotiating committee, the steering committee, I think we called it. He was involved in all the close top discussions in the union. And after the strike was over, Mickey was the, see, when, well, I'm a little off step on that. We didn't put out the organizer that soon.
It came out first as a weekly. And then
it came out first during the strike.
Yeah.
And then when the strike was over, there was no need now. The organizer was a daily strike bulletin, in my recollection, the first in the country that day.
That's right. That is correct.
And shortly after the strike was over, the organizer, we quit publishing the organizer. And there was a couple of reasons for that, of course. The official paper for the Minneapolis Labor Union was the Labor Review. And Mick was one of the early editors. I think Farrell was the first. But let me think now, Chris. I got to put something in perspective here. We were down at 225 South 3rd Street. That was our office. Mm-hmm. And we moved to 257 Plymouth in March or April of 1935. And now it's coming to me. It was in about February or March that we got expelled from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. And then we put out the organizer. And that came out really when we could afford to put it out. It was set up to be a weekly, if I remember. Weekly or every 10 days or. And shortly after that, Mickey became the editor of the organizer. And he served in that post. And then, the time element there, I'm going to have to think about that one too, not now, but between now and the next time we talk. Mickey went down to St. Louis, Missouri to help the Laclede gas and electric strikers. And he helped them down there for a short period of time, a couple of months maybe. And then in the early part of 35, Mickey Dunn and I and Farrell were in Fargo, North Dakota, and we helped that union. That strike was broken. That was a sad thing. but we were helping there, doing the best we can on it. And then Mickey became the full-time editor of the organizer, and he served in that capacity until, I think, he may have still been the editor in title, but he was, he had so many other accomplishments that, well, not accomplishments, other, so many other duties and other things, and he was, boy, there was just so much going on that Carlos Hudson done most of the writing then. Mickey done a great deal of the writing. Of course, Farrell always did. He always made his mark. Mm-hmm. But Ray Dunn, Carl Skoglund, Bill Brown, Grant Dunn, they didn't contribute anything to the... Well, Ray Dunn might have, but... it was Farrell that was kind of the mother hen there, and he always made sure that things was on an even keel, and he looked after everything. I don't know how the man ever found out the time to do what he did. He was a family man with three growing kids.
Uh-huh.
But Carlos Hudson came in then, and he done a lot of the writing, and eventually, I believe, when Mickey went on to be Secretary Treasurer of the Joint Council, Carlos then took over the writing of the paper, and I think he might have been the editor. You could look in the, if you access to the Northwest Organizer,
yeah.
It would show in the masthead where, who it was. But you see then, of course, Mickey was all the time on the go. He was in this negotiations and in that negotiations. And of course, the period of time that we were outside of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, that was a very trying period. And Mickey was one of the wheel horses there that, you know, it was a rough way to go. Not a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when we got back into the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, there was just so much to do, and Mickey was gone. And then when Pat got killed, now I think Mick had a post in the Teamsters Joint Council before Pat got killed. I know he was on the executive board of the Teamsters Joint Council. I don't know if he had a post there or not, but I know when Pat got killed, Mick become the secretary. And I want to believe that Mickey had a post in the Teamsters Joint Council, but I'm not sure. I'd have to think about that some more.
Oh, I could check that out, too.
I thought that he was a while there, he done some, whether he was a, he couldn't have been the secretary treasurer, the recording secretary maybe, or something like that. They had that lash up there, you know. But Mickey was just, he's the kind of a guy that you could have go any place, represent the union, and could and did represent very ably. And everybody seemed to have their work cut out for him there, and there was those of us who were out most of the time talking to the drivers and listening to their grievances and trying to organize new fields. And then there was the job that Farrell had in the office, secretary, treasurer, and then later on, of course, recording secretary and on the staff. And then finally again, secretary, treasurer, and Bill Brown. And Ray Dunn was kind of an advisory capacity then, and Ray spent a lot of his time with his own political interests.
Mm-hmm.
That is, he, Carl and, well, Carl, you know, for all the way that they talk around there about all the guys that were politicals, I can identify Carl and Ray as the two political people, and then later on Farrell. But for the most part, Carl never devoted any time away from the Union. He was there night and day, and so was Farrell. But Ray would be around the Union. He wouldn't take any money. Ray would not take a dollar from the Union as a paid official, as I remember. If he ever got any money much out of the Union, it was on a basis of they sent him to do a job, or it was a per diem basis. Uh-huh. I don't recall Ray being on the payroll of the Union. He devoted just one hell of a lot of time for free to that Union, rather than take money, and he was concerned, and I have great admiration for Ray. He was concerned about his political thoughts as much as he was the Union. And of course, without Ray and Carl's political thoughts and their whole ability to work with and understand people, which came from their whole life, I suppose there wouldn't have been a Minneapolis as we know it today. Or there would have been in Minneapolis, but I mean, what we knew, what developed out of that would have never come had them two guys hadn't have been there.
Well, I think you're right.
Hmm?
I think you're absolutely right.
I didn't probably see it when I was 22 as much as I can put it in perspective later. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see when you start to say, now, how did this happen? Why did we do that? Well, you had a on-the-scene explanation for it, Chris, but what really brought it about? When you start to start off from square one and start going across the sheet, then you figure how everything is related, see? And I've had a lot of time to think about things that happened and how, and then you put them together, and you can see where Ray and Carl, in the first instance, and of course, Mickey was closely aligned there with his brother, but I never saw Mickey as a sincere, dedicated person as much as I did Ray.
Uh-huh.
Mickey had a hell of a good understanding, and so did Grant. I don't want to take nothing away from him. But I never saw the sincerity of everything in the politics as great as it was with, first with Ray and Carl, and then Farrell. You know, Farrell was far outshined Mickey and Grant, in my opinion, on that kind of dedication.
Mm-hmm.
So Mick played just one hell of a role through the whole thing, and
he sounds as though he was someone that could really be trusted, who had more than just a basic understanding of what was going on, but whose best efforts were made in interacting with people.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I don't want to ever make or leave anyone with the thinking that Mickey Dunn was a PR man.
Mm-hmm.
He had so many other things, but one of his attributes was his ability to be a PR man. And Mickey never lost sight of where he was going or where he come from. But he was able to perform admirably any time that you had a situation. And of course, Grant was too, but Grant was a different dude, see? We'll talk about Grant later. But Mickey was just affable. And I don't want to use the word suave. That kind of greasy and oily to me, but Mickey was honest and straightforward and quick and everything, you know, and he was just a likable guy. He was not a comedian like Bob Hope, but he always had, and he was the kind of a guy that you could understand even if he was jovial, he wasn't a buffoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mick played some. Oh, and he was at his best, you know, in those big rallies and mass meetings. He just had a gift. And he could handle it. And so could Bill Brown, and they were just a hell of a team, and they paired up. They liked one another, you know. And they were together quite a bit. And I'll tell you, that was hilarious days when them two guys was together. And but Mickey, you know, had a hell of a social understanding. And that's what kept him grounded. He didn't need to, no one had to write Mickey's lines out for him. And then, of course, in the process, he married Jill Flaherty. And I don't know if Mickey had been married before or not. He never said much about it. But he married Jewel in about 1937, the summer of 37. And one of the reasons I know that was, why I can place that, was we went out to Mickey Dunn and I and Farrell were invited out to Sioux Falls, South Dakota to help organize the South Dakota drivers. And there was a local there called 749, and they wrote, would they come out, and if they'd get the money together, would we come out? I remember Farrell told me that, well, this is the time, of course, I'm getting a little afield now. We already had laid the plans, you know, for organizing the North Central District Drivers Council. And we'd been doing a lot during that summer. And Mickey and Jewel had not been married too long when we went to Sioux Falls. So I think he married Jewel in the summer of 1937. And she was a small little girl, too, smaller than Mickey, so they made a nice little couple, you know. But all during the days of the tough days in Minneapolis when we were outside of the Teamsters Union, Mickey played a goddamn hell of a role during that period of time, because he could be charged upon. I never saw Mickey while he'd take a drink, and more than one. I never saw him drunk or lose control of himself. Now, Bill Brown was a pretty good drinker, too. And so was Grant, and so was Carl. They were all able drinkers. They could take a few drinks and didn't bother them. There's other people that can't do that. But they were all pretty well able to do it. But Mick, is all his period that I know, he was very, very conscientious about the union. There was never no problem about trying to go on and get a better job for myself. And he had absolutely no time for these little ward-healing politicians. And he understood what the score was. And I don't know what more I can tell you about Mickey, you know, about his early background in his life. I didn't get much more out of that than what I've told you.
Did he and his brothers get along well?
Oh, that was the amazing thing. They always seemed to be able to understand what was going on and got along famously. They didn't get along with Bill.
Right.
But all of them. I only met Paul once, I think, or maybe twice. But Fenton and Mickey and Grant, God, they were all, I never see a cross word all the time I was around them. You know, when you ask the question now, never come to me that you ever, you know, siblings have little quarrels and spats and fights. I know we do in our family. But I never saw any there evidence itself with them guys. Never once did I, you know, there was never no argument. They all knew where we were going. And they all had respect for one another. They had a lot of respect for Ray, both of them, and Fenton, too. And even Fent, although he wasn't mixed up in the day-to-day affair in the Union, he was well-posted and had the same outlook. So they were all well-grounded, and they were a cohesive unit, I'll tell you that.
Well, maybe they're... The similarity in their purpose, their common purpose, is what, along with it, the common bond of being brothers, helps them get along as well.
That's right, that's right. Now, the relationship would build on, that's another thing, although they disagreed principally and politically with Bill Dunn, yet they never were nitpicky about it. They never were nasty. And when they says, well, Bill's got a different philosophy in life than we have, he has adopted one mode of life and we've got another, and we don't see eye to eye, and that was about all you'd get out of him. And I know they were bitter political enemies.
Well, it sounds as though, from what you said, that the family relationship was actually very close, and there was a great deal of care and concern expressed about their own mother.
Yeah, and oh, that was, yeah.
Their desire not to hurt her by their...
oh, that's right.
Was motivating them.
They did that, you know, but at the same time, there was no outward display of affection or anything, but they were close, you know. And it seemed like they had some kind of, what the hell do we call it, mental telepathy?
No kidding.
One would say something, and I'm damn sure that the other guys didn't have a chance to talk about it, and yet they'd some more or less seem to come up with the same understanding. So they were pretty grounded. Now, the only one that was a little bit, well, Mickey and Ray, they never espoused any nastiness or surliness. But Grant, on the other hand, would sometimes get surly-like, and this was attributed to the problems that he'd suffered in the war, and he'd been gassed, and I think it bothered him, like some people that have hay fever, and at certain times of the season you suffer with it, and then other people had other ailments and manifest itself under certain conditions. But every once in a while Grant would develop a kind of a moroseness, almost to the point of being surly. And, but Grant was a very able guy. You know, he was able too, but, although he had the humor, he come across to me as a little different than Mickey and Ray. But Grant was a hell of a guy. Now, Ray once told me that Grant was the sharpest of all the Dunn brothers. Ray himself told me that.
Hmm.
And Grant's life had been a little bit different. Grant, I don't know if we want to go on to, I ain't much more I can think about Mick right now.
Okay. Well, we haven't got a whole lot of time left on the tape. I think that it...
We better try to take Grant and go through with it as one shot.
Yeah, I think I'd rather do it. It helps
yeah.
Grant can break it up. I think it's helpful. I have, over the next few weeks, I have exams. Exams, which means that, and I also have this proposal to write to get the money to try to get you out here. So I think that we better wait a few weeks before we talk again. Is that all right with you?
Good.
Okay, let me take a closer look at my calendar and see exactly when the earliest is I can spend an hour and a half with you. Well, my last exam is May 14th, which is a Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it would not be realistic for me to arrange a conversation before then, given the number of...
Oh, my goodness, no, I wouldn't consider it. And then we got to sit in tomorrow to consider.
Pardon?
We got to sit in tomorrow to consider then.
Well...
That's the 17th of May, that's Norwegian Independence Day, and you're in Minneapolis.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Well, let's see, we could have a conversation, but I don't want to make it too far in the future. Is either Friday the 16th or Monday the 19th of May?
Well, how does Friday? Is Friday a bad day or a good day for you?
Well, it's a fair day. It's not a great day.
Yeah.
But I can do it.
Well, no. I mean, whichever. Would you rather talk Monday then?
Let's see.
Lots of times Monday's a bad day, you know, for people. It isn't much to me now. I'm retired.
Yeah, I have a staff meeting at 9:30.
Well, that don't probably fit.
Well, maybe we should... How about May 20th? That is kind of a ways away, but...
May 20?
Yeah.
That's good enough.
Okay.
What day is that?
Now, that's a Tuesday.
A Tuesday.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So I'll give you a call at... We're changing our time zone here.
What? To what?
We're moving ahead an hour as of Saturday.
As when? What Saturday?
As of this Saturday, we're moving ahead an hour.
Well, I don't know when we do either.
Okay.
Well, whatever. I can, you can drop me a note if you want to confirm the time.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I'll do.
Hmm? The hour, I mean.
All right.
We agree on May 20th.
Right. Okay,
and
I'll try... Yeah, May 20th is definitely it.
Well,
I'll,
whatever it will be, it'll still be 9 o'clock your time.
9 o'clock your time, yeah. I'll still call you at 9 o'clock your time, whatever time it is.
I mean, yeah. Okay.
Okay?
All right.
All right, well, thanks for talking with me. And if I have any good news about, or any kind of news about this grant before May 20th, I'll give you a quick call, okay?
Yeah, all right.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mr. Maloney.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.